Next speaker is Todd Henneford, needs no introduction. I'm sure that many of you in the audience have had questions from your patients regarding mesh and how bad it can be to them. And Todd is here to discuss that and take it on with a strategy to discussion with your patients about mesh. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. This has been as good a session on hernia repair, as good a lecture series as I have ever heard. The speakers have been from Vedra and John and Will and Igor have completely knocked it out of the park. Just fantastic lectures on contemporary hernia repair. I'm gonna jump truly into contemporary hernia repair because this is happening in my office every day. It's picked up speed over the last couple of years. To essentially every single patient now is asking me about mesh and what are my strategies, where did it come from, what are my strategies, and then some of the considerations of going forward. These are my disclosures. I mean, so how did mesh become a four-letter word? I mean, we have been putting in mesh and effectively putting in mesh since the 1950s, since Francis Usher discovered and popularized the use of polypropylene mesh in Houston, Texas, that have migrated around the world, and more than a million people a year just in North America receive mesh. I mean, really, where the phenomenon has truly taken off is in the slings, the pelvic slings. This has become a hot topic in the westernized world, certainly in Australia, New Zealand, in all of the UK. It's become not only a hot topic, but being reviewed by the government. There's no question that this has reached maximum effect on Twitter and other social media. If you put in an Instagram mesh, most of what you will see will be remarkably negative. And of course, most of this is not based in science. But I will tell you, personal interest and personal consideration and personal effects and personal strategy and complications are terribly important. There is no question. But these. Both in Australia, New Zealand, Scotland, and certainly in England, have now garnered headlines, both in the on personal accounts and Twitter and that sort of thing, but also in the mainstream media. After extensive investigation and discussions in Australia, and most recently the health minister is actually, this was less than 10 days ago, apologized to Australian women for what he has called a real tragedy in causing agonizing pain for decades. This is now rippled through all of mesh, and again, this was 10 days ago, and the government has pulled the ability for a gynecologist to use this for slings in the pelvis. It is now in the UK, and I will tell you, it is washing up on the shores of the United States. In this article, which subsequently followed that in the major newspaper in Australia, talked about the senator saying that this is the worst thing since the thalidomide. I mean, it is coming to us. And what we have to focus on, we're going to have to focus on as hernia surgeons, is why, where, how, and of course, where we place our mesh. A lot of what you've heard this morning. Indeed, things that are sensational, such as this is a person who's in Parliament in Scotland who said that he just attended a memorial service for someone who died of cancer following related complications to mesh, that mesh now causes cancer. I mean, it is coming. You know, much to, like you from a popular TV show, winter is coming, there is no question. It is now certainly circling up to hernia meshes. In the United States, there have been numerous lawsuits around the vaginal slings, bladder slings, etc. Lawyers have become experts in mesh and truly, truly experts in mesh, studied mesh and litigated this now for years, and it is coming to hernia mesh. There is no question. This is from Great Britain. Again, more from Great Britain saying that meshes are going to be examined and will not only be examined by people in healthcare, but also by Parliament. Sensationalism continues. This is from just a few days ago, from the end of September, and this has now circled the globe. This has had more than 100,000 hits. This discussion about this gentleman who had so much pain after a hernia repair that he contemplated suicide. I am being absolutely trolled as a hernia surgeon on Twitter. This was sent to me and about 25 other surgeons who do hernia repair. And you kind of laugh this off. It's kind of like the parabolic curve in life. You know, it's a real big problem. Holy crap, it's a big problem. Then you start to think about it, like data and things like that. And that's not such a big problem. This is craziness. And then it starts circling up when it comes back to you. This is coming back to me. And it actually makes me a little nervous at times when I open my Twitter account and I receive things like this. And then again, more sensationalism. But we're going to have to address it as surgeons. No question about it. Again, this is in Parliament. This is from the UK. There are three things they're actually going to talk about. And the third thing here that the Health Administration in Great Britain is going to look at is surgical meshes. So what do we see now? You know, you can't get online without, if you type in mesh, look at what you see. Essentially, the advertisements that we see online, the advertisements on TV. Indeed, I just did a Google search yesterday, and you look at the total number up here, and I just put in hernia mesh, and you know, I did another Google search this morning, and it's growing like rabbits. Went from 5 million to 6 million almost overnight. It's not new in the United States, of course. This has been going on. And this is an article, this famous article in the Wall Street Journal from 2012 about this hidden secret about patients undergoing hernia repair and chronic discomfort and chronic pain. One of the best studies looking at the discussions of physicians talking to patients about chronic discomfort after inguinal hernia repair was done in Great Britain, where only 8% of those surgeons who were monitored, and that would include both trainees and practicing physicians, talked to their patients about chronic discomfort after inguinal hernia repair, which is the number one complication. Part of what we have to do absolutely is education. You can't stand back and just say, well, this is a patient that just doesn't know what they're talking about and I just don't have time for this. You know, what our patients think about and what involves them and what them, you know, the interaction we have with them as surgeons, we have to take their concerns absolutely to heart. And we have to educate them, no question. So what do my patients do? We just started a survey in my office, actually surveying patients. Initially, it was a quality survey for myself to make sure I'm covering all the things that my patients wanted to hear about. But if you look at this, 84% of the patients, without prompting, asked me about mesh. 28% of them asked that the operation could be done without mesh. Almost 8% demanded no mesh. However, after I sat down and talked to them, and I talked them back off the ledge, all consented to mesh, but two of them requested no permanent synthetic. 100% had seen these commercials about lawsuits, and that is the number one way that patients asked. So how did you get your information? The number one way they got their information is by these lawsuit commercials on TV. We've got to educate them. 16% said they did not ask immediately about mesh. You just mentioned 84% did, because, and of course, John, you're going to say something about this, because they thought I knew what I was doing. So that means only 16% thought I knew what I was doing, I guess, if you want to interpret it like that. But what's the evidence? We'll go quickly through the evidence. I mean, let's walk back from the cliff, the edge. Let's talk about what the real science is in this. And then we can help our patients. And if any of you guys want this series, I'll be glad to send them to you, just send you the titles of these. But you know, we can start looking at the Cochrane series. This is from 2002. This is opening or hernia repair with mesh. Hernia recurrence rate significantly improved. Pain, OR time, length of stay, and time to return to work will all improve with mesh. Let's walk forward. Cochrane review, 2009. List of risk of recurrence significantly improved when you used mesh. Chronic pain, complications, and hospital stay were the same. Come even 2018, mesh improved risk of recurrence, pain, time to resumption of normal activities, neurovascular injuries, hematoma, slightly increased chance of wound complications and stroma when you use mesh. So let's base this in science. Let's talk about recurrence and chronic discomfort. Again, looking at additional studies, so on the same thing. And I hear it all the time, and this popped up very quickly, but I hear all the time, you know, about my technique is better. I mean, I've heard about the Tassarda technique, and I think it's fine. I guess I've never used it before, but you see advertisements online about how it's so much better than mesh. There's 8 randomized prospective trials looking at it, and it's no better than a mesh repair for pain or limitations afterwards. Look at a national study. Let's just look at, you know, Denmark, and these guys have done a beautiful job tracking nationally what you see nationally. Open mesh repair, laparoscopic repair, and the suture repair. Significantly improved outcomes. You know, I've heard over and over again about, does it increase, you know, the problems with men and having kids and that sort of thing? 29 trials, best study I've seen on this, most recent study from this year, no significant increase in male fertility when you use mesh or hernia repair. So let's just walk this back. Even the European Hernia Society and their beautiful studies that they've done, and Mark Mesray and those guys have done fantastic, Kanzi and those guys have done fantastic studies demonstrating what is the best thing in the literature. And again, they strongly represent or think we should use mesh. How about ventral hernia repair? Exactly the same. Surgical site infection slightly increased, no difference in pain, significantly improved outcomes as far as recurrence. Same sort of thing here again, another meta-analysis just recently published, decreased recurrence rate with mesh, no difference in pain, no difference in wound complications in this study. Again, more of the same, even in umbilical hernia repair. You know, Hans Jekyll, one of my world heroes in surgery, and Johann Langer, they have done so many beautiful, more than 50 randomized controlled trials in surgery. But again, looking at umbilical hernia repair, we've repaired millions of them, and this is one of the best studies out there. And John Fisher showed this earlier. Even for 1 centimeter defects, long term, you improve outcomes. Where does it all come from, too? Companies aren't helping us. Let me just say that out loud. They're not helping us. It ain't perfect, but many of these and the meshes we use need to be trialed. We also need to educate our patients. Where did the pain come from? Number one, this is an international study we did that Igor was a lead in and presented this at the European Surgical. The number one reason for postoperative pain is preoperative pain, and you've got to take the time to prepare your patients. And this is an inguinal hernia. In patients who have terrible pain preoperatively, they have a 15, almost 16 times increased chance of postoperative pain. The same exact thing, this is an international study looking at pain prior to ventral hernia. If you have a patient who has significant pain prior to ventral hernia, you've got to prepare them that they may have pain afterwards. That old thing that Dr. Polk told me many times as a young resident, it could be true, and unrelated. True, you have pain and a hernia, but they may be unrelated. What's happening in my clinic? I mean, we are also hurting ourselves as surgeons. We got to make the right choice for mesh. And I've heard surgeons will say, you know, I don't care what operation it is, I'm going to put a synthetic mesh in everybody. And we're the only people in the planet that would do that. Cardiac surgeons and plastic surgeons and neurosurgeons, they're not putting synthetic materials in contaminated defects, among other things that we do. But certainly, I see patients like this in my office, you know, and this patient, you know, had a complicated hernia repair, and then, of course, you know, they take out an infected mesh, and then they put another macroporous mesh in. And this is what she looks like afterwards. Terrible mesh infection, huge hernia failure. We got to, you know, and I'll just tell you, you know, did I have an enterotomy and put synthetic mesh in for a while? I did, and we tracked our outcomes, and our mesh infection rate was 18%. Pick me. And you have patients like this, has a small bowel fistula, and then they put a mesh after they resect the small bowel fistula, and this is what she looks like in my office. We, too, are causing this for ourselves. There's no question. Choose the right mesh or no mesh for the right situation. And I'm not going to mention the name of this mesh, but one of the things that I'll accuse everyone who we do and use things that have no data. A mesh was launched in 2013. You can see its growth and use. Almost 37,000 patients before the first clinical data point of any human data ever. Not even a case report. And almost 37,000 patients have been treated with this mesh. If this mesh fails, what have we done with no data? And I'm also getting trolled by my own patients. So this is a patient who, you know, who had umbilical and bilateral hernias that had no complication. I get an email from them saying, you know, was my mesh involved in this FDA recall? Is there something I should be suing about this? Here's another patient who 6 days after I saw her in clinic, wants her path report, wants her operative notes, and why haven't I sent them to her yet? This is what's happening now. Me as a, you know, and I've, you know, who would want to fix hernias in their life, but for me as a fix a lot of recurrent hernias. I've gone back and looked, and so I've received now 37 letters so far this year from lawyers who are trolling, wanting to know, wanting the patient's operative note, the path reports, and that sort of thing about the patient's mesh. And I'm getting these letters, even patients who have no complication, they just have a hernia recurrence. I mean, just like this. I received this yesterday in a patient who had a flank hernia. It was failed. He's asking for her notes. This difficult to repair flank hernia here. So she came back to see me, and she had pain before her first operation, pain after it failed, pain before I operated on, pain after I completed it. She's got no hernia recurrence. When she came back with pain, hadn't changed. I CT scanned her. And they're looking for someone to sue. And even things like this. So this is I received this email where someone had an inguinal hernia repair. They're complaining of generalized weakness. Someone did a laparoscopy after, and they took a biopsy of the mesh, and for God's sakes, they saw giant cells. And they want to know if I'll help sue somebody. It's happening. So I mentioned the parabolic curve. When I first started looking at this, I'm like, wow, this is out of control. Then I start looking at the science. But now, I got to say, this really is an issue. We've got to do something about it. I think education is really important for our patients. I think we have to take our discussions with them about what meshes we may use, what the alternatives in the operating room, what might happen in the OR, what may change my decision making in the operating room. I think you have to take it seriously, and I think you have to have it with every patient. I think we have to make the right choice of mesh, for the right reasons, and certainly that plays a big role in it. I dictate it now. I dictate it my operative note about my mesh choice and why I'm using what I'm using. And again, you'll say, well, dude, you're standing at the bottom of a funnel, and there's no question I am, but it's coming. I do believe it's coming. And I have to thank our fellows in the lab. We started talking about this, and so they started making a patient education sheet for us that we're going to give out to all of our patients. And it also refers them to the FDA website. If anybody wants this, and Katie and Sean and Erling have made this and started putting this together, but I'd be glad to share it. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Todd. That was very informative. I think that the interest in these topics are evidenced by the number of people in the room and the standing at the back. So we do have time for questions, however. I would ask that you come to the microphone, tell us who you are and where you're from, and limit your questions to one question. If you want to target a specific speaker, that's great.
Okay, I'll kick it off.
Go ahead.
So I would just, again, thank you very much to the panel, but my first question would be, Igor, you talked about the movement from an advanced laparoscopist to a robotic surgeon. I mean, do you think robotics is going to be a mainstay, and you think it'll overtake open and laparoscopic ventral hernia repair in the next, in the foreseeable future, 4 or 5 years?
So the issue right now is access to the platform and how expensive the capital cost of a platform is. And so I personally, and this is my personal opinion, I think robotics is a natural evolution, and this is going to be part of MIS surgery, where slowly as access becomes more available and as residents and fellows go through training, this is what they're going to choose to use. This is going to happen, I think, over the next decade maybe more. What's going to happen is also more companies are going to be coming up with their own platforms. So hopefully the capital cost of a platform is going to be more affordable than it is right now. What was that?
Does she think it's going to be?
Yeah, I think it's a mainstay. Wait.
Okay, question?
Yes, John Page from LSU Health in New Orleans. Dr. Henneford, I guess it was very appropriate we're near Halloween because you really scared all of us with your talk about the mesh. So my question is, are there any other solutions besides mesh?
Well, right now, it's what we got. And I think that one of the crazy things is how many hernia repairs that we do and how few patients are actually entered into trials. It's my personal belief that if a patient has a foreign body implanted, they should be given a card with that foreign body's name on it and a website with the FDA that they could actually report outcomes. I think that would, or therefore it could be investigated. But at this point, in the American population, even John did a beautiful job talking about like preventing hernias, that it's mesh use, which is probably the most important thing that we can do in the future to even prevent hernias. So right now is what we got.
Thanks.
Thank you. Next question.
I'm Pramod Shinde from India. I have a question and a comment for Dr. Vedra Augustine. This was regarding your presentation on the algorithmic approach for component separation. My first question, the question was regarding endoscopic anterior component separation. I felt that in today's day and age of the anterior and the tar, the endoscopic anterior component separation is fast becoming a forgotten operation that we have had to do. So what is your opinion about endoscopic anterior component separation as a part of the algorithmic algorithm that you have? The second is a comment that I've seen your excellent slides about the preperitoneal repair, where you close the defect later on after you have assessing the defect size. So I felt that maybe an endoscopic anterior component separation would be an excellent tool, an armamentarium in your armamentarium for repairs. Your comment, please.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I think endoscopic component separation certainly should not be forgotten. I think if you're doing an open operation, you're already in the planes there where you could potentially do a TAR. But I think if you certainly think that there's an external oblique needed, doing an endoscopic separation and then doing a preperitoneal release, I think that's a really good way to spare your perforators.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Condal, an acute care surgeon from Riverside, California. The majority of hernias that I see are emergency cases. At minimum, the patient is symptomatic. Often it's incarcerated or strangulated. What is the role of mesh in those cases? Thank you.
Good question. Who wants to tackle that one? Will.
Yes, so we were actually just talking about this earlier before this panel. I think in that scenario, when you have an abdominal catastrophe, and clearly an indication not to use a permanent material, I think just something, whether it's a dynamic closure device, a biologic mesh, something to at least try to take some of the tension off the further separation of that fascia. And so yes, if you bridge with a biologic, that is going to ultimately recur. However, I think you're going to be in a better place than if you just left it open, closed skin, because your fascial, the data that Mike Franz, they did it at University of Michigan, just shows you get the fibrosis of the rectus and it continues to separate. So you're dealing with a 30 centimeter defect, 6 months to a year, which is just not going to be closable. So I think there's a role to try to offset some of that continued diastasis of the defect.
So some people would say macroporous mesh in that situation is acceptable. What does the panel say about that?
So a macroporous mesh in a contaminated case, I wouldn't do it. I think that one of the things that you'll see in the future is you're going to see a rapid acting Botox for patients like that you may actually want to inject them with Botox when you know you're going to have a patient who's going to have their abdomen open for 4, 5, 6, 7 days. And I think that actually will be something that will truly facilitate and counteract what Dr. Cobb just mentioned a moment ago.
Okay, so we're going to go to the back on the right. Oh, please.
My name is Francis Christian. I'm in Saskatoon in Canada. There is data, good data, and lately from Canada in David Urbach's study from Toronto that tissue-based repairs give as good or better results than measure pairs in inguinal hernias. Now, my question for the panel is there concern that we are teaching our residents only how to use the mesh, and with the result that they don't know tissue-based techniques that have been proved to be as good or in some cases better? And I don't think patients or lawyers, for that matter, have a problem with us using mesh in huge incisional hernias. And even in the question of the vaginal sling, the question is simpler procedures, if you have an alternative, should we be using them? Isn't it cheaper too?
Who wants to tackle that?
Yeah, I think the big problem with a lot of the tissue-based repairs for inguinal hernias is they're just not reproducible, right? I mean, you've got expert centers, particularly one in Toronto, I'm sure that you're referencing, that have really impeccable results, but those haven't been translatable when you take them to the masses. And I would argue that, rather than having someone do a handful of tissue-based repairs where you can potentially trap nerves, pull a lot of things together under tension, create pain, use the same mesh tension-free technique. So if you want to use a bioabsorbable mesh or something that's not going to stay long-term, I would rather see someone do that in a situation where they don't want to use mesh than to do a repair they're maybe not comfortable with.
It's interesting, the study you referred to. I am from Toronto and I live down the street from the Shoalace Hospital. And my office, the Shoalace is very selective, and that was one of the criticisms of the paper, very selective of the patients that they operate on. And the most common, or one of the common patients in my office, is the Shoalace Hospital reject.
And there are other.
Next question at the back, please.
Yes, Bob Maxwell, Chattanooga. For all the prophylactic mesh placers, do you code for this, or do you just say I'm a nice guy and I ate hernias, and even though it takes a little extra time and risk, I'm going to do it for free? I'd just like to caution all the acute care surgeons doing urgent laparotomies, unless you've thought about this ahead of time and get consent, I wouldn't do it.
Thanks for the comment. Really glad you brought that up. And I would agree. I think that you have to talk with the patient about doing a prophylactic procedure. Certainly there's going to be some inherent risk to soft tissue dissection, adding mesh, but there's definitely some benefits, as we kind of discussed and touched upon earlier. We actually do have a code. It's what's called a Category 3 code, currently a tracking code. So I would encourage you all to use that code. The code is 0437T, 0437T. The code is not currently paid for, but it's a tracked code. I think in certain circumstances, the code may be paid for. It's going to actually be hopefully converted to a Category 1 code, a fully reimbursed code, in the next several years. Currently, there's sufficient evidence in the literature to achieve conversion from Category 3 to Category 1 based on publications, but what the AMA typically wants to do is ensure there's actually adequate use of the code to reflect kind of what it should be in clinical practice. So if you use the code, it's going to be very helpful to convert this to a Category 1 code, and the code will be what's called an add-on code. So for the index procedure associated with the prophylactic mesh, it will add on RVUs on top of the procedure without being a cut in half like a typical additional procedure code. So again, 0437T.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Back up to the front again for the next question, please.
My name is Brian Pertini. I'm from Pittsfield, Mass. Kind of a combined question between Dr. Cobb and Dr. Milianski. I know for the ETEP procedure, which I've seen multiple times and I'm a big fan of, how many of them are you doing robotically compared to laparoscopically?
That's a good question, and it's the answer is it's a question of access in my hospital. I operate about 3 days a week, and only one day a week in the robot. What I do right now in my practice, I pick out or select out what I think are the most difficult cases, and I do them robotically. Typically, that includes reoperative procedures, higher BMI patients. The higher BMI patients are really the ones that the robot makes my life much easier, because I do not have to find the torque. Again, those procedures are more complex dissection. I feel, early before, I did it for about a year before I jumped in the robot, I did a lot of all of those procedures laparoscopically. And the conversions that I had, some of them were due to adhesions and normal things, but a couple of cases I had because I just couldn't, I was so fatigued, like 2 hours in the dissection,
because of how much torque I was feeling. I just couldn't go on because like my hand was like shake and like the torque of abdominal wall. So I hope that answers your question. I think overall you have to ask yourself a question also, the laparoscopic part is how reproducible it is. And you know the surgeons in India and Romania and some Europe are doing this laparoscopically. But it just hasn't, my experience has been around now for 3-4 years, not a lot of surgeons here in the United States have taken on laparoscopically, but once the robotic part came all around, it seems like it's taken off quite a bit. Well, that's a good thing, a bad thing, that's another point of discussion, but one thing I'll emphasize is, if you're interested in those procedures, take your time, understand anatomy, because what I'm worried about truly is, it's a great technique when it goes perfectly and you do the right dissection, but it's so easy to get lost, and you know, I'm seeing a spike at least, people talking to me of complications, so we're gonna see very unique complications if we're not careful, kind of taking the time, kind of introducing the practice.
Thank you.
And we'll go to the front on the right side, please.
Hi, I'm Joseph Oliver, Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. Do any of you use the laparoscopic instruments like the FlexDex with the articulating, and how do you think those would fit in as opposed to the robotic ones, as they are maybe cheaper and less of a learning curve, but give you that advantage of the robotic as far as the degrees of freedom?
I've actually trialed it, you know, just using the classroom, and it's going to take a bit for me as a laparoscopist to be able to use the FlexDex. It's not intuitive. Let's just put it like that. For me, the robot is fairly intuitive and that sort of thing, but the FlexDex is I think there is something to it. I'm not going to discount it because I had time for like 90 minutes with it or an hour with it, and that's about it. But it's not intuitive.
Yeah, I've never used it in a clinical setting, but just here at the meetings, previous meetings, and I think I was very excited about the instrument, and when I played with it, there's a learning curve with it, just like with anything else, and you really have to spend the time practicing it, figuring this out. I've seen some videos of other surgeons using it that are now proficient in it, and it looks pretty cool. If that's an alternative and you want to introduce it to your practice and you spend the time, it's just like anything else, there's the learning curve with it. You know, but it's not a cheap device. It's right now, from what I understand, it's not a reusable device. It's a one-time use. So there's a certain price tag with that. But again, that's an exciting kind of alternative technology. And I think what's going to happen as we move forward, not only like stuff like FlexDesk, the robotic platforms perhaps are going to be more mobile and a little bit different than what we imagine right now as well. So there are going to be choices that all of us are going to have.
Thank you.
And we'll go to the back on the right side.
Yeah, hi, Matt Johnson from Las Vegas. Got a question as to how are you guys dealing with the backlash of the physio mesh? And you know, when I asked that, it's in regards to patients that had an effective hernia repair and they're doing fine. They haven't come back to your office and so forth. And in addition to the patients which have come back with a recurrence.
I guess one way I'm dealing with it is trying to help the company with those cases, to review those, to see where, you know, were there cases of fracture and things like that. And what you find a lot is kind of what you're alluding to is they're not, recurrences weren't due to the mesh itself per se, whether the mesh wasn't large enough at the initial repair, it wasn't fixated properly. You know, usually there's some technical issue. And so when patients come to, you know, and want you to take their mesh out because it's the recalled mesh, of course you scan them and show them, kind of walk them through that, and I don't offer them an operation to take out their mesh if they have a perfectly good hernia repair, because those are pretty hard to come by, particularly for these complicated ones. So, again, try to educate them, walk them through the scan, show them what the mesh looks like, and try to walk them off that ledge. Have had some cases where the lawyers send the letter with the patient and want the mesh, and like kind of what Todd showed, and just take tons of pictures, document everything. Go out, tell the family, hey, this is what I found. It was a hernia, remote from the mesh. It was either a suture site recurrence or trocar site. The mesh had nothing to do with this, and they're kind of bummed when they hear that. But just documentation, is incredibly critical in those situations.
Yeah, I think the hernia is the most dangerous, the one you redo. You know, when you're talking about a redo hernia, if you're going to do it open and take the mesh out, I can't do robotics like these guys next to me, but that patient has a 30% or so complication rate. And leaving the mesh in, the complication rate is certainly going to be a whole lot less than that when they don't have a hernia recurrence.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question, and I'll ask at the back on the left, please.
Yes, thank you very much for an excellent presentation. My name is Daryl Tooks from Atlanta, Georgia. Do any of you all see a role for the mesh suture technique with the gynae mesh that's recently been recalled, or any of you all in using that technique at all?
The mesh suture for closure?
Yes.
So I think Dr. Damanian has definitely shared some of his kind of early clinical experiences with this. I think it's definitely kind of a kind of out-of-the-box way of thinking about this. And I mean, again, some of my kind of concerns are long-term data, kind of what the indications will be. But I think it's kind of a creative way of thinking about kind of really fundamentally what the problem is when we have an incisional hernia occurrence or recurrence. We're basically talking about, you know, a suture, you know, tissue failure, a healing failure. And I think that, you know, it's very encouraging to kind of see some of the work he's done and some of the preliminary results. But my personal feeling, no offense to Greg, I don't know if it's ready for prime time as of yet, but I think as more data comes out, I think we're going to learn more about that type of approach.
Okay, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their contributions. I'd like to thank the audience for their excellent questions, and this will end this session. Thank you.